video of his on YouTube. We made it like a year ago, and it's, I think, really great introduction to this topic. I just wanted to throw that out there so people can have more nuanced conversations as they're debating with the timber industry or their neighbors or whatever, just to talk about the different ways to manage a forest that are not falling into the black and white dichotomy that we're oftentimes presented with.
Well, Alexander, you are speaking my language right there. I love to hear that. That is what I preach all the time. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. But I really appreciate you joining me today. And yeah, I hope that we get to talk again soon. Congratulations on this research, and how lucky and special that not only did you get to do this research, but you're actually putting it in practice. It's not just sitting there gathering dust. So congratulations to you. Thank you so much for your work, and thanks for joining us on Coast Range Radio.
Yeah, thanks for the conversation.
And that's it for this episode of Coast Range Radio. Thanks so much to Alexander Harris. You can find links to everything we talked about today in the show notes of the podcast or at our website on coastrange.org. You can hear an extended version of this conversation on our podcast feed. And one more time, make sure to subscribe or follow Coast Range Radio on any podcast app to get all of our episodes. You can learn more about the Coast Range Association at coastrange.org. One more time, my email is michael@coastrange.org. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Do you love music but don't have the energy to find new stuff? Can't decide whether you want to hear indie rock or hip hop, electronic music or singer-songwriters? Then tune into Another Late Night every first Saturday at 3 a.m. only on KBOO Community Radio, or stream online at kboo.fm/anotherlatenight, where we've got it all.
I'm Grace Gearing, Medicine Eagle Reed. I am broadcasting Negotiating Dramatic Events, a new show on KBOO, the third Wednesday at 9 a.m. I am a social justice activist since the 1960s. The purpose of the show is to make life more wonderful for me and the people around me. And I'm 80, and I'm going to take my elderliness and share what I have found so that everybody can be seen, heard, and understood. Negotiating Dramatic Events, the third Wednesday at 9 a.m. Thanks for tuning in. Really appreciate KBOO.
KBOO. Good evening. You're listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. My name is Emma, and I use she and her pronouns.
I'm Sheila. I use she and her.
Great. Well, we're just we're joining you tonight. This is part of an extended series of conversations dealing with the topic of family rejection. As you may or may not know, transgender people have a very difficult time sometimes with their families of origin, and even with other families too. And transgender people have been collecting and telling stories in the same way that all of us in the queer community have, of dealing with our families of origin. And how has that been for us? Some people are really lucky. Some people have great families who are loving and supportive and nurturing and accepting. Some people have families that don't really care one way or the other about the fact that they're transgender. Some people have families that reject them or even shun them or disown them. So there's a whole wide spectrum of how people relate to their families of origin. And tonight we're going to be having some conversations with Sheila and myself, and we'll be talking with some other folks who are part of the Transpositive Collective about our own personal stories. How have we dealt with, how has our families responded to the fact that we came out, whenever we came out, and what kind of stories do we have to share about that? So that's kind of what we're going for tonight. But first, let's just do a check-in. Sheila, how are you doing, Sheila, tonight?
Oh, doing good tonight. I just watched the Academy Awards, which I always enjoy. I used to go out to the Suquamish Reservation and watch there because I didn't have television on my boat, and it was really cool to be able to be there. Usually I had a whole big, room to myself, even, because it was, there was like so much, there was like a downstairs bar that didn't get much action, and I could look out at the beautiful water, and it was wonderful. So
that sounds great. You know, there's something very queer about the Academy Awards, isn't there?
There is. Yeah. It's the whole concept of drama, and you know, I used to, you know me, I used to do different voice impersonations of various, that one time I had a group and I did this thing where I tried to enact the entire Academy Awards in a 5-minute summary, including all the technical awards.
And it's, I mean, the pageantry is definitely part of, it's the pageantry. And the presentations, I mean, the dresses alone are, I mean, everybody wants to see what are people wearing.
Oh, yes. Everybody's the best dresses in the world, you know, and jewelry worth more than the Lamborghini you're driving that night, you know.
Yeah, It's also it's kind of a cycle. It's a, it's a rite of passage for our culture. Like every year, it means here we've gone through another year. This is I mean, this form of entertainment is so central to our culture in every way. It's how we tell stories. It's really what people do. I mean, so much of the conscious lives of people is bound up in this medium, in this, you know, of movies and television, specifically movies. So,
well, there's a lot of drag culture dependent on many tough gal, even abrasive actresses from the old black and white era. One of the standard lines is, fasten your seat belts, is going to be a bumpy ride. So you can use that for just about everything.
Were there any, like,
fasten your seat belts, is going to be a bumpy ride.
Were there any queer themes this year in the, were there any queer shows or?
No, especially considering last year, there wasn't really much going on for the LGBT group this time. It was a little lower key. It just felt a little different this year. That was just my take on it. But,
you know, a lot of it was probably just because of the writer's strike.
Could be. And I think we're still kind of going through, you know, people reconnecting to movie theaters after the COVID thing. And so there's a lot to there.
Yeah, we're coming out of the tail end of COVID.
Yeah,
I can't think of, like, I wonder, like, I mean, if you think about the Academy Awards from the past, can you think of one that was really, I mean, a show or a movie that really spoke to our experiences? Trans people or as queer people?
I think the last year one had all kinds of gay LGBT themes in it, and I think it got Best Picture. I just remember that one of the actors, I think he got Best Actor, was had been in The Goonies, and I haven't seen that movie yet. It's been a year out, but it's just there's some years where you just sort of feel a gravitational pull. This year everything was towards Oppenheimer. The most nicest thing this time I thought was that there was a comment on how sad, you know, the wars are and in Ukraine, and I thought the acceptance speech was outstanding. And I kind of like the ones where people's guards kind of come down and people can really share what they're feeling, and you can get an insight into their whole life as family. And the thing I always notice is how often they will cite a wife or a mother or father or, you know, or a teacher or their children, and they will just acknowledge the power of having their whole family behind them with the award. And I think that kind of bridges into our talk tonight about how important family is to trans people, and how often we experience a sense of deprivation in that area, especially, at least in terms of affirming our identities. And I can't entirely blame families for that, because I think families do not like their kids to be rejected or enter into a thing that will be economically challenging. And the things you do at one period of your life, you may not feel exactly the same at another period of your life. And then if you're a late transitioner, there's the question of how do you incorporate your past into who you are now? There's so many things in play. And then when you add to it that the concept of, quote, family values is used to devalue our experience and to make us feel even more exiled. So the topic I was suggesting tonight was this idea of what it felt like when they ran into a brick wall when they came out, and all of a sudden it was like the family became a stranger to the trans person, and the trans person seemed to become a stranger to the family. And there isn't sufficient maybe therapy to try to help all the parties bridge that, so that things that don't become tragedies that don't have to be, people being barred from seeing their grown up kids, being barred from, you know, a sudden instantaneous divorce the moment, you know, the marriage was going fine until this. Sometimes transition is also the time when people have been dealing with their trans feelings by substance abuse. And so now all of a sudden they've got to get into recovery and deal with transition at the same time. There's just like so many things in play. Well, one of the things I oftentimes try to bring forth the trans elder experience, that I transitioned early, and yet at the same time I was walking into a world that was so rejecting, and yet I didn't want to be so marginalized that I couldn't live the life that I had planned for myself minus transition. When I came back from studying in Europe, my plan was to come back, take a job for 2 years, save up some money, and go right back to Europe again, because I felt more welcome over there than I do in my own country. And I was surprised that just being trans I could see that everywhere I went, there was this sense of devaluation. And of course, in those early days, there were no civil rights. And there was our only exposure, since people didn't read books about being trans, and there were a few books even written, were the exposure that we got on talk shows, and those were extremely exploitive. And the thing that irritated me the most was they would listen to four or five trans people on the stage describing their experience, and then they say, okay, well, now after our commercial break, we're going to have a doctor who will tell us what's really going on. And the thing that I wanted to say is, you've already heard what's really going on. If the people can't speak for themselves out of their own experience, what good is it having somebody interpret it from a completely outside respect? And even if it is an empathetic vision, it's still, and so in other words, we were pathologized in the mere telling of our stories. It was the idea that we couldn't just hear the reality of what people were experiencing and why it was so insistent and why they would take so many risks to follow that particular path. And it trivialized it to say, it's either something to be exploited, or it's just something that's just odd, or it's something that can be used as cannon fodder for a therapist to be able to kind of posture as the all-knowing one that could somehow from outside tie it all together.
Yeah. So, you know, people have different kinds of reactions to transgender people. I mean, the story of how we deal with our families is really complex. I think it's fair to say that a lot of transgender people have to deal with rejection from one or more family members. And there's a whole process to getting rejected from your family. Some people get rejected just straight out. They get kicked out of their house. They end up on the streets. They're teenagers. Or maybe they're older, but they're still having some kind of relationship with their family. And they lose the connection with people that they love and that they care about. And the only reason that's happened to them is specifically because they're transgender or non-binary. It's specifically because of their gender identity. And the consequence of losing the connection with the people in your life who you've relied on your whole life, the people who you've seen and who you've identified with, can just be really devastating. I mean, it really creates a situation where transgender people have to be incredibly self-reliant. And it's a high bar. It's a really high bar. It can be. Now, on the other hand, there's also transgender people who have really loving and nurturing families. And I've met people like that too, where, you know, people really go out of their way to make sure that their transgender kids, their transgender loved ones are, you know, really loved, are attended to, like where pronouns really matter to them, where their transition matter. They take every kind of step that they can to really support their family members. I know people that, one of the things that's happening right now in this country, I know people who care so much about their transgender kids that just the fact that their kids have said that they're transgender means that they're willing to uproot their entire lives and move all the way across the country to states like Oregon, California, Washington, and in the East Coast, like East Coast states where it's safe to be transgender. We actually talked about this in our show. I don't know if you remember last month, Sheila, when we were talking with the folks from the Equi Institute and from Pride Northwest, and they were talking about these stories about families, whole families, who have moved across the country just in order to protect their transgender kids. And that's an amazing kind of love and an amazing kind of respect, you know, that you would have for your transgender kids, that you care so much about them that you would leave your home. But it's still, even for people who love their kids, even they still have to experience a certain kind of exile because they're having to move from everything that they know, and maybe even mm-hmm. from relationships that they care about, but they're doing it to sacrifice for their children. So that, because, yeah. you know, I mean, ideally we live in a world where parents take care of their kids and where parents really mm-hmm. love their kids. And at the base of, I mean, at the base of how we idealize family in this society, we imagine that a family is entity, it's this unit that's there for you, and that there's these mm-hmm. bonds, these primary relationships, bonds between mothers and daughters, fathers and sons, between mm-hmm. brothers and sisters, that is so strong. I mean, we really idealize those relationships. Now, for me personally, I don't know that I agree that those relationships in and of themselves are something to be valued and to be held in such a high position as we put them in our society. But irregardless, that is where they are. I mean, when you think about things in people's lives, when you think about experiences people have that are spiritual, that are fundamental to their identity, that are just absolutely core essence of who a person is. Like, if you mm-hmm. took all of those things away from a person, then mm-hmm. in the course of their lives, they would feel in some ways like they're nothing. This idea of family is so core to the kind of cultural narratives that we each tell ourselves, whether that's good or bad, whether it's real, if it has any kind of a biological root, or if it's just a cultural construction. It doesn't matter, because it's so core and everybody's speaking the same language. You know, people are speaking the same. It's interesting too that we have the same language, because there have been times in the past when we didn't have the same kind of language about family that we do now. But now this is the language that we have. And so it's what we have to work with as transgender people. And when we think about that script, the script that we carry is really what's at the core of a lot of these problems. I mean, because script says that there are certain things that you can be and there are certain things that you can't be. So if you're born as somebody's son, then you can't be their daughter, according to this cultural script. And if you then say, oh, no, that's not true, I'm really female, I'm really a woman, then for so many people, it just violates everything that they believe about the world, because they take it personally. I mean, there's something about, wouldn't you say, Sheila, that there's something about language, that in some way we essentialize everything about language. There's something about how we know the world. Even though we know the world intuitively, we know the world with our bodies, you know, without language, we know the world with our bodies. But there's still mm-hmm. something about language that so essentializes our experiences, because we have so many people around us and there's so many experiences. And so it's hard to live in a world where there's nuance and where, you know, some people say, well, I'm really a girl. You think I'm a boy, but I'm not, I'm a girl. And people just, I don't know, there's something about that that just makes people go crazy. They just can't handle it. It's like a nuclear bomb has gone off inside their head, you know, mm-hmm. and they feel like it's just a complete violation of their values in every way. And it's hard to understand. I mean, as trans people, it's hard to understand that, because I know for most of us, the act of transition is really a really liberating experience. So it's like we kind of wish that the people who have these nuclear bombs going off in their head where they just can't handle our transition, our loved ones, would be able to handle that in a, you know, and feel the way that we feel, you know, but somehow it doesn't happen.
Well, one of the things that bothers me the most lately is this concept that's called transgender ideology. And the idea is that somehow transgender people are trying to take people who are non-transgender and confuse and or recruit them so that they will question their gender. And that's so ironic. It turns the victim into the persecutor. And I think that that's such an unfortunate thing, because our entire experience is exactly the opposite of that. What we're trying to do, most of us, is to merge as evenly as we can. And for many people, it's to go completely unnoticed. I took a little different avenue on that, because I admired the drag queens because they looked like movie stars to me. They just looked fantastic. And I just thought, I didn't want to be somebody that was, you know, walking down the paper aisle, squeezing Charmin and saying, look what a woman I've become. I can pick the right bath tissue. It's just that trivializes what women go through. And it also trivializes women when everything that they are is caught up with having children and raising children. It doesn't mean that that isn't a great gift. In fact, it's something that I think most of us really envy families, because we don't have them sometimes. Mm-hmm. We sometimes have it from prior marriages, but we don't have it from our own selves.
Right.
And I think that is a central thing. In fact, I keep looking, and we talked about Academy Awards, looking at all the dresses. I mean, none of these dresses are things that you could have for streetwear. There's just no way. Whereas you could be dressed in the male attire and you just look like you were going to a major outing, but you could walk the streets like that. You could run. You could, as a woman in a dress, you are. I keep noticing the things that get emphasized, which is usually bare shoulders, bare arms, upper half of the body, right at bust level or just below. And I look at all these things and I say, this whole thing is like screaming like a big neon sign, woman, 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 with these various insignia. I deal a lot with postmodern philosophy that deals with the ideas of how we use signifying, how a sign value. There's a whole branch of social science called semiology that deals with how we deal with signs and how important they are. Well, I think the problem that people have, especially if moving from the male to female direction, is the idea is, how can you be a woman if you don't have a number of signifiers? So what happens is, as transgender people, we go around trying to get sufficient signifiers that we can, quote, pass as women. And the problem with that is we can't do a lot with our voice, because our vocal cords have lengthened during puberty. We put so much of how we signal even vulnerability, having a higher pitched voice, having a softer voice, all of those things, even the choice of words. If we start sounding authoritative as a woman, we almost put a premium upon being somewhat hesitant, as though somehow you're more female if you have to look for the right word. And if you don't talk like that, then the idea is, oh, well, see, I could tell it was a man all the time. And I've seen so many very pretty transgender people, and people will say, well, I could see through it. I said, how do you see through a solid human body? What they mean by seeing through it is they turn it into a masquerade, because part of that is how we define women in general. We see a woman first as a woman and only secondarily as who she is as a human being. With men, we don't think a whole lot about, you know, does he have a good butt? Does he have a, you know, is he really strong? I mean, a big heavy sport coat does not, or business attire does not show off if he's been lifting weights or anything. So we don't do the same things with men. We don't sexualize them in the way that we do women. But the mere fact of having that sexual power, especially when you're young and you're really pretty, it really does make a difference. And then the obverse side of that, the downhill side of that mountain, is once that starts being marred in any way, all the power positions that are specifically womanhood oriented, from being a model to even being a newscaster, A lot of these things, you don't see a whole lot of older people, even in politics. You don't see as many of the really, like for instance, in the State of the Union response the other day, they had the young woman senator from Alabama speaking. They didn't go from somebody that could have presented a long-term perspective on the Republican Party. They went with a newbie. And of course, part of that was they're trying to bring in the housewife vote. So they had the whole thing in the kitchen. And there's been a lot of flack. In fact, they did a Saturday Night Live sketch on it the other day. It's really cute if you haven't seen it. But you see the problems that we run into is that the reason that we're divorced from having a family and the reason that our families can hurt us so deeply is because family and gender roles are how we structure society. And being in the middle just doesn't cut it. And that doesn't mean that people shouldn't explore the idea of not having to rely upon sexual signifiers to identify them, which is what I think non-binary is all about, is just saying, can I step out of sexuality for a minute and just be seen as me so that I don't have my voice muffled by how I appear and I don't have to feel either a surge of power because I'm pretty or a sense of I'm looking down because people are saying, you know, nobody's going to pick her up in a bar, as if that should be the entry ticket to even being a woman, is how attractive would you be sitting on a bar stool? And the idea is I don't, many women would say, I don't go to bars for that very reason. But so see what do you think about this idea that we use sexuality as the stepping stone into family? You don't get married until one party finds the other attractive and visualizes them as husband material or wife material. And we've got a whole script designed for what's a good provider for, and what is a, now those things are getting blurred. And when they get blurred, it gets dumped on us that we're the ones that are sitting there messing it up with our wet sponges, smudging it all out. And we're not doing that. We don't have that power to do that. We don't have the numbers to do that.
Well, so I'd like to start with this. One of the most interesting things that you said that really, I think, describes so many of us is it's really ironic because we aren't able to start families of our own. And we also have to deal with our families not being able to handle us. And it's really complicated because not only are, so it's like we have these two challenges at once. One is trying to manage the relationships with our families of origin if they have a problem with the fact that we're transgender. And that's like a whole world of work. I mean, it can take so much emotional effort, communication, language, interaction, engagement, if you have a family of origin that doesn't really know how to deal with the fact that you're transgender. And then on top of that, when we're trying to create families of our own, we have to navigate through a world of people who don't really know how to deal with the fact that we're transgender. So they don't really know if it's something that they really want to get into, if it's a space where they'd like to navigate or go. That's why, I mean, it's really interesting because you find that a lot of transgender people. They either live on their own or they end up with somebody else who's transgender. I mean, I know at least enough people who are transgender who are living with somebody else who's transgender to know that that's a thing. You know, I mean, it's not the norm. I'm not sure exactly what the norm is for transgender people. I think it's probably a lot of transgender people are living on their own. I mean, there's a lot of transgender people in relationships too, just kind of navigating queer space. I think some of that depends on how old you are, how young you are, how pretty you are, how handsome you are. You know, I mean, all of the things that apply to queer culture in terms of dating. I know that there's a lot of transgender people who want what's considered a more stereotypically heterosexual, heteronormative kind of experience. Like if you're somebody who's a transgender woman and you're looking to get into a long-term relationship with a man and have a normal kind of, a stereotypical heteronormative kind of relationship, that can be a real challenge. I mean, I don't know a lot of transgender women, for instance, who really successfully pull that off. Now, I do know a lot of transgender men who do that very successfully. A lot of them will date people who are in within their own queer communities to begin with. I mean, I know a lot of transgender men who have successfully gotten together with other people who were, you know, within their communities, who were lesbian or who were bisexual, or who somehow were associated with the queer women's community. And somebody within that community transitioned all the way to transmasculine. And they have very, I mean, that's the most successful, I have to admit, like of all the relationships that I've met personally, and all of everything I'm saying tonight is just anecdotal. I want to say I am not in any way a professional about this. Everything I know is just based on my own anecdotal experience with all of the different kinds of communities that I've engaged with. And the ones that actually excite me the most out of all of this are people who practice what you might call relationship anarchy. And those are people who have decided we're going to throw the binary out the window, we're going to throw the family out the window, we're going to throw the baby out with the bathwater, and we're just going to have relationship anarchy. We're going to acknowledge the validity of all the different kinds of connections we make with people. We're going to acknowledge all of our sexualities, all of our genders, all of our different kinds of identities, and we're just going to go with it, you know. And those kind of people are really interesting to me. I'm trying to get someone on a show sometime this year to talk about relationship anarchy, because it's been about 5 years since we visited this topic. So, but I think that for most of us who are transgender and non-binary, a lot of us fall right into kind of right down that path that most people in our culture have to go through, where they have some experience with heteronormative like experiences. Either they come from a family that's mostly made up of heteronormative people, where there was like, you know, I mean, there were two people who maybe one identified as a man and one identified as a woman, and they had children. And we were born because of that. And then maybe we were raised in some variation of those relationships, maybe with the same parents, or maybe just with one parent who then dated other people who were also heteronormative. And maybe we have one extended family because we came from a family where the parents stayed together, or we might have two or three extended families because there might have been a divorce or two. And, you know, we might have half brothers or sisters. And, you know, like I said, that extended, that's more typical of most people's experiences who are transgender. Would you say that's the case?
Well, it's hard to say. I've done more reading than necessarily knowing tons of trans people, because one of the things that I kind of made up my mind early on was that I was going to take this circus out on the road, and I was not going to back up. In fact, that, as I look backwards, is part of the problem. I was so angry that gender made this much difference in how I was treated, that if people were going to assault me, which happened, or if people were going to yell things at me, which happened, or throw rocks at me, which happened, I would just, you know, people used to say, how come you're so good at walking on high heels? I said, chasing after people who had called me a horrible name in a parking lot in high heels. If you can do a 50-yard dash in high heels, you can do just about anything else going on, you know.
Yeah.
So
no problem.
I wanna give some quick examples of the way families can hurt us. The most obvious one is the classic case of somebody who divorces a spouse because the spouse has entered in transition. So that's very sad. The other is where grown-up children will reject a parent that is going through transition. Another one is where siblings will reject you and or refuse to call you by the name that you've adopted. Another one is where parents will say to a trans youth, this isn't going to go on in my house. You're welcome here if you stay the person you've always been to us, but if you insist on changing, you're going to have to hit the street. And there's the streets of America are littered with rejected trans and gay and lesbian young people that have been thrown out on the street and then subject to all manner of sexual abuse and exploitation because they're still growing up and they're also still looking for somebody to identify with. That's the other big problem is how, when you're growing up, do you identify with this sex of the parents that you would like to be, especially if their style is not yours? Like, I didn't have the same personality that my mom had, and yet mom and I were really super close, and it's always very sad to me that my being trans probably interfered a lot. You know, I of all the family I went out to see when they brought Gone with the Wind back in the movie theater, I'm sitting there next to my mom, and I said, if you did a little survey, a little exit poll on how many people were out watching The Sound, a mother older child of person. That was something that you did. You didn't even do it as often with your daughter. I would say that is almost a classic gay male experience of being very close to the mother. It's why so many women love having a gay male friend, because the gay male friend can almost instantaneously enter into that kind of mother-son closeness but it usually doesn't go to the extent of total acceptance. It's like the mother doesn't necessarily accept the gayness of their son, but they like the closeness. And then some psychologists will say, well, there's the problem. You identified with the wrong sex because you spent too much time with the opposite sex parent. You should have stuck more with your dad. And it is true that some trans folk have father issues. I know I did. But at the same time, I also knew how to be a pals with my dad once in a while in a very special way. So I kind of found a way to work through things. But the thing that makes me sad at this point is that I carry so much anger and so much sorrow. And I internalized a lot of that rejection so that there were options in life that I just simply I skipped them because I said, I will be rejected in this context. I have absolutely no hope in this area. And that's a terrible thing, because I needed somebody to say, that is where you need to keep pushing. If you surrender the game before it's even started the play, you're going to find yourself in a little cage and you will find your life minimalized. And that's what I see in my life. And I don't want it to happen to other people where they are. To me, that's a huge waste of human potential. I'm really sad that our community has so many wonderful people in it that live marginalized lives or even die young or kill themselves with various forms of drugs or alcohol or denial. This is a problem that has been raised now, and we have to deal with it. And it won't be driven back under the carpet, no matter what laws are passed in Florida. There's no way that a major social issue can be raised without pointing its finger at the rest of society and asking it questions of just how much silent sorrow goes with being a successfully adapted person to sexual norms. If you have no stress in your sexual normativity, that itself is a problem, because it presumes that the norms are in fact healthy. And if we look at the degree of addiction and depression in the quote, genetic female population will realize that the way we structure being a woman isn't even good for people that have never had to go through transition because they always were there.
So Sheila, I'd like to visit, there were some really interesting, they're not hypotheticals, but they're actually categories that you mentioned a few minutes ago that I think are really great categories to explore one by one. So I'd like to start, and by the way, we're not going to get through all of this today, so I'm hoping maybe you can come back on the show later on this month or next month and we can continue this conversation because it's a really good conversation. But let's start with the spouse who rejects their partner because they're transgender. Let's talk about that for a couple of minutes. What do you think?
That's so classic, and I've kind of heard it from the wife's point of view too, because one of the very interesting things is that being an out trans person, all of a sudden people would come out and say, we've got a member of the family that we're trying to deal with also on this very issue. So in a way, through my life, I've been kind of an apostle going out kind of, and people would come to me, and then sometimes they would tell me intimate things about how their family's structured. It's almost like I was being a confessor to them, and it always intrigued me. But usually the thing with a woman who rejects a transitioning husband is the sense that, one, she feels that she's failed as a woman. If she was sufficiently attractive, he wouldn't be going out with, quote, the other woman, except this time the other woman is the female part of the transitioning individual. So that's excuse one. And I don't mean to diminish it, because oftentimes this is told me with great amount of tears and sorrow. The other is fear of lesbianism. You know, will people think we're a lesbian couple now? Another one would be, and this is not impossible, sometimes the transitioning male is a lot more attractive as a woman than the woman that he's married to. And that can be a problem because there's some jealousy factor going on. And the other is the sense that transgender people sometimes go through a period of not being completely financially or emotionally responsible. You go through a belated adolescence, and all of a sudden the husband is not just dressing as a girl, he's dressing as a teenage girl, and he's 40 years old. And I say his because at that point the transition has not really gone through. But how could we expect it to be otherwise? I mean, who grows up without going through the stages of growing up? It's that you've never been able to go through those experiences, let alone be coached, so helped to go through it in a responsible way. Then sometimes all of a sudden, from being this quiet, depressed male that she was married to, all of a sudden the wife is married to this giddy, excited, bright-eyed little creature that's running around like Bambi. And that is just too much for them, you know?
Yeah.
I don't even laugh because it really hurts them. But those are usually the excuses that come up.
I mean, I feel like there, just like with anything, Sheila, I feel like, you know, there's two sides to it. I mean, it's definitely, so like, I can definitely imagine it also though, from the partner's point of view. I mean, if you were somebody who was raised, or let's just say you're heterosexual and you were raised female, and as a female, what you always imagined was a certain kind of partner, like somebody who would be a certain type of body and would play a certain kind of role in your life. Now, if that person then suddenly told you, maybe you'd been with them for a while, that they're going to change their body, in ways that like you don't really find attractive. I don't know that it's necessarily required or should be expected that that person should have to stay with that other person who's going to change their body in such a dramatic way. Now, you would hope that there's something much deeper that connects those people than just what kind of body they have, because people go through all kinds of changes in their bodies through their life. You know, the way that they think changes, you know, people's bodies change. And ideally, like if you're with someone and you're willing, really willing to be with them over the long haul, then you understand that their body is going to change over time. And in that way, you would hope that maybe if they transitioned, then their body is just changing in a really different kind of unexpected way. I mean, but like I said, bodies change all the time. And people have all kinds of things happen to their bodies. And hopefully, the idea is that if you're with someone, if you really want to be with them over the long haul, then you're willing to be with them in the different ways in which their body changes throughout the course of their life. So ideally, a transgender person would just be another kind of way in which their body is changing. And hopefully this would be their body changing in a really good way. But I can also understand how you might not want that. I mean, you might have quite, like if you wanted to have children, if you wanted to have children biologically, you know, you may be concerned about what kind of changes will happen to your partner's body. Will it be able to produce children? You know, that's a really big question. I mean, a lot of people get together because they want to reproduce and they want to have their own genetic offspring. And, you know, it's certainly reasonable to, you know, for people to want that or to expect that out of certain kinds of relationships. I don't think that for us as transgender people, we should hold that against our partner if that's a concern that they have and if they don't really want to be with us because of it. I mean, there's nothing, part of what I'm trying to get at, Sheila, is that I don't think that there's anything fundamentally sacred about a certain kind of idea about what a family is. There's all kinds of families. And if a person is in one kind of a relationship and that's not working, there's all other kinds of relationships that person can move into. And they don't have to be limited to a particular kind of relationship. So, you know, if they're with a partner and the partner is okay with them being transgender, if they're able to see beyond whatever they thought, then that's great. Then that means they probably will have an even better, more healthy relationship than they had before. But if one or the other isn't able to deal with the changes, then maybe it's okay for them to separate. You know, but now if there's kids involved, it gets more complicated.
Well, here's a very real fear, and I don't diminish this at all, is that let's say that one of the reasons that a female identified trans person has married a woman in the first place was to do the very level best to perform sexually and to act sexually and to think sexually in a way that would satisfy the primal image of sex at that point, his partner. Well, there's a real fear in the spouse that's not transgender that if you're wanting to be completely affirmed as the woman that you say you are, you're going to go out and sleep with a man. And if you do that, you're not only violating our marriage covenant, but what do you expect of me as your spouse? I mean, I'm looking for, quote, the man I married, and all of a sudden I've got someone on top of me or somebody who's basically wearing a bra and nylons, and one maybe doesn't find that very attractive, and two just feels massively alienated by the entire experience, so it causes this tremendous anxiety complex and even homophobia that had never been present before suddenly gets very, very I mean, there's just, like, in other words, I think of marriages as very difficult things in the first place, so to make them harmonize with values, style, sexuality, career, pressures of raising kids. There's like so many different factors in play. And you can imagine this, you know what it's like? It's like moving from the inches and feet and miles to the metric system. It's like the wrenches don't fit anymore. It's like nothing fits anymore. And that's a real problem. And I can't blame the spouse feeling like that. And then religion, you can never take religion out of this. And so there's ways that people are wired sexually that are sometimes just not permitted by the religious values that we're raised with, and let alone prior commitments that have already said, till death do us part, I've kissed off not only all other women, but I've kissed off men per se right at the start. So a lot of trans people, in order to square themselves with their faith, will say, well, sexual acting out is not even in question for me. I can't, there's no way I can make it work. And I didn't have to, in my own personal life, I didn't have to break anybody's heart over this because I've never been married. But the fact of the matter is, if I had been, that would have been difficult too. So I guess what's emerging out of the shows we've done so far is that this is such a big topic that it actually has five or six shows out of it. One would be husband and wife relations, husband and children relations. What does it feel like if you don't have children? And if it's not there, then what can act as a substitute for that? So anytime you touch anything that's trans, it's like the grand finale of a fireworks show. It's like rockets are going everywhere, right? There's so many issues to talk about. Well, it's what makes us fascinating people.
So there you go. I think we're going to have to call it a night, Sheila. It turns out we have about six shows to cover. So I hope you'll come back and we'll get some more into it in a couple of weeks. Well, thank you, Sheila. Thank you so much. Well, it's been a real pleasure talking with you. We'll be getting more into issues around family and what does it mean to be in a family as a transgender people, and how do we deal with rejection from our families on our next episode of Transpositive. So thanks so much, everyone, and have a good night.
Transgender people don't live here.
I've never met anyone who's transgender.
I swear I don't know someone who's transgender.
Transgender and non-binary people like me hear this all the time.
But according to the HRC Foundation, there are more than 2 million transgender people in the United States.
We live in every community across this country.
You might be surprised to hear that there are more transgender and non-binary people in the United States than there are
Starbucks, McDonald's, and Walmart locations combined.
In fact, if you put us all together,
there'd be more non-binary and transgender folks than the populations of DC,
or Nebraska,
or Maine,
or Idaho,
or West Virginia.
As a matter of fact, 15 states have a lower population than the amount of trans folks in the U.S.
So here are a few things to keep in mind.
You don't always know when a person is trans.
But we're your neighbors.
Your coworkers.
Your students.
Your customers.
And even your friends and family.
We exist in every culture, todas las culturas, throughout human history.
And while we're more visible than ever before,
sometimes you just don't see us.
So when you hear about politicians pushing for discriminatory bills,
know this, these bills address problems that aren't even real.
Problems that don't actually exist.
But we do.
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 And we need your support.
Thank you.
even walk in my sleep. What's up around me seems to always creep. Every night and day, I hang my head and weep, yes, and weep. I love my baby, I want him for myself. If he don't be mine, he won't have nobody else. He has left me. I'll do the best I can. I must do like Keith, get a friend any place I land. Now I got the don't have news. Can't be satisfied.
Hi, this is Emma. I am a co-host of Transpositive, and I'm also the current president of the board of directors here at KABU. At KABU, we prove every day that people-powered radio has the ability to bring us together across distances and give us hope when we feel despair. Your friends at KABU want to remind you that generosity has the same power. Join thousands of KABU supporters from all around the world, and let's rally together to build stronger communities. If you can, just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number 44321. And thanks so much for your support of KABU Community.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.